Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 56. New antiviral strategies with Carla Kierkegaard.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there to get the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark, 10 years.
So potentially one of the things that will end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun is the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare to our closest evolutionary relative.
So let's get started. We're really lucky today. We have two fantastic virologists with us. I'll introduce our guest host today, who is Vincent Racaniello. He is professor of microbiology and host of two podcasts that are on the air right now, This Week in Virology and This Week in Parasitism. And there's a new one coming up soon. I'll let him mention it. And he's author of a textbook called Principles in Virology. And one thing really interesting about him, and we're going to have to pull him on for another show, is that he was the first one to produce an infectious clone of a virus, of an animal virus, that is. So welcome, Vincent.
Mark, always great to be on Futures in Biotech. Thanks for having me.
And, oh, did I mention you're a professor at Columbia? I said professor of microbiology and microbiology, but I might not have said Columbia University. Well, so welcome. I really appreciate you coming on because we're going to be talking about viruses and, you've thought about them for a few more years than I have. I'd like to also welcome Dr. Carla Kierkegaard, and she is she's a professor and chair of the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at Stanford University School of Medicine. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be here.
You and Vincent almost crossed paths academically, didn't you? Before we get into viruses, let's put people into context here. So Vincent did his postdoc in David Baltimore's lab. And did you postdoc in his lab or PhD?
I postdoced in his lab. And when I went to interview, I still remember going in to talk to Vince. The music was on so loud that I said hi and tried to introduce myself. And he said, what? And I said, hi. And I tried to introduce myself again. And he said, what? And then I kind of realized he didn't want to talk. But he's gotten a lot friendlier as he's grown up.
Yeah, I don't listen to music anymore. That's probably why.
So yeah, it's amazing. So yeah, and that was in Boston?
Cambridge, at MIT.
Wow. Those were some really exciting times at the start. Vincent was sequencing the first animal viral genome, one that is particularly small, and so it was a polio virus, right, Vincent?
Right. It was poliovirus, which we found out was 7,440 nucleotides long, which is relatively small as virus genomes go. Not the smallest, but for me at the time, this was 1979, it was really big because I needed to find the sequence of that genome. And nowadays, George Church could do it in a blink of an eye, but it took me a year to do it.
Wow. I remember sequencing DNA in 1995, 96 and spending weeks for a couple hundred bases. You were doing it 15 years in advance, more. So maybe Carla, you could tell us a little bit. So your work on RNA viruses and specifically the replication of the viruses or the RNA replication But before we go into any of the details about the biology of a poliovirus, could you tell us a little bit about what the scale of this virus is? Because when I'm a cell biologist, I always think in, you know, in the size of a cell. How can we put this into context in terms of size and biology?
Well, when I teach non-majors about viruses and microbes, I always try to imagine that they're a million times bigger than they are. And if you are a million times bigger than you are, then you can lie down and your feet are in LA and your head is in Boulder, Colorado, which is why where I used to teach. And at that scale, a cell is about the size of a large lecture hall, which is usually where we are. And a vaccinia virus is about the size of a watermelon. And a poliovirus is about the size of a lemon.
Wow.
So that's how we do it.
That's
and
great.
A bacterium is about the size of a Volkswagen. So,
wow.
You know, these things help me anyway to, and a million fold is a good metric. So that's how small they are.
I'm picturing Colorado to California, Stanford. And so at one lemon, and how long does it take to kill you? Is that a pretty toxic lemon?
Well, yeah, it can take. Well, if you have Ebola virus, it can take, you know, about a day and a half, right? Or cholera, which is the size of a very long, skinny car, maybe a limo, a day and a half.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's pretty good. But they're not alone, you know. There are millions of them. So they take up a lot of space.
So, Carl, you said the lecture hall, the cell is the size of the lecture hall. Is that the analogy that you made?
Yeah, a large one.
So in a cell, would that lecture hall be relatively empty or relatively full?
It would be so full of stuff that you could hardly make your way through it, right? It would be full of like viscous, it would be full of like styrofoam balls of all different size connected by jello.
How would you move around in that?
Yeah, there would be, yeah, so I guess microtubules in the cytoskeleton, right? So you'd pull yourself, there would be like bungee cords connecting around in the cell.
Right.
And you would pull yourself through that viscous mix along those cords.
Right.
But the viruses have the incredible ability to cause that lecture hall to just literally explode in a short period of time. How long does it take for a virus to cause lysis?
Well, some viruses can do it in 4 hours. Polio can do it in about 7 or 10, depending on the cell type. Right, Vince?
Yeah, and you know, if we move into the arena of bacterial viruses, there are some that can do it in 20 minutes. In fact, my colleagues here who used to work on viruses of bacteria said they could do 2 experiments in a day if they planned it well, because the virus grows so quickly.
So maybe you could tell us a little. Go ahead. I'd like to know a little bit about biology.
The reason I started working with RNA viruses had nothing to do with the fact that they were viruses. Actually, I mean, my training was really in DNA protein interactions. And one of the most exciting things that happened when I was a graduate student is the work of Tom Cech and others, who showed that RNA could be, you know, so usually information flow, like in our bodies, goes from DNA, which is our genes, to RNA, which are called the messengers, to protein, right? And then there was an amazing discovery in, I'm not even going to say the date, but that RNA could have function, right? That it was not just information, it could have a function. So suddenly there was this idea that an RNA molecule could be like the mother molecule, the original origin of life, something that had both information and function. And then by replicating itself, you wouldn't even need any proteins. Maybe that was how life was before there was all the fancy storage machine, which was the DNA, and then the proteins, which were the workers, right? So that concept, which was articulated mainly by Tom Cech, was so fascinating to me that I just wanted to work on RNA. And I wanted to work on RNA specifically, that encoded something that was almost alive. And that turns out to be a virus. you know, in the hopes that we would get some glimmer of prebiotic life and how it might work.
I've never heard that before. I've never heard that explanation, Carla, for why you started working on viruses. But, I noticed you said there was RNA once, there was an RNA world, and then the fancy DNA came along. And I wonder, that implies that DNA is better in some way, and that's maybe why we all have DNA today. Why is that? Do you ever think about that?
Yeah, well, DNA is better because it's chemically more stable, and because it can make these double helical structures that are unwindable at, you know, reasonable temperatures. You can have basically two copies, right? It can repair a lot easier. I guess I'm just making this up, of course. But, you know, DNA is more stable than RNA. And it's, you know, therefore, if you're going to live a long time and have a lot of progeny and not make a lot of mistakes, maybe that was the choice.
Mm. Well, I mean, there are a lot of viruses with RNA, and they're pretty successful, but there are no cells with RNA, right? It's always DNA.
That's right.
And maybe
that's right.
Also,
so I think it has something to do with, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, so it might have something to do with longevity.
Well, back in the time, I suppose, when life existed on Earth solely as RNA, right? That's what you're suggesting, which is pretty interesting. I mean, it's the age-old question: how did life start on Earth? But if the RNA could act as an enzyme and replicate itself and propagate, and that's the essence of life, is that alive? And then you said you wanted something that was close to alive. Is the virus alive? I mean, Vincent and I always have this argument. And even with Peter Pelliez, he joined in, and Vincent and Peter didn't agree. Is that virus partially alive? Is RNA alive when it's in that primordial soup?
Well, that, of course, becomes a semantic question, which has to do with your definition of life, which is more religious than scientific. So one will continue to disagree. There's no way to resolve such an argument.
Okay.
Can it propagate? Can it change? Yeah. Right. It depends on your definition of life, of course. So the RNA world theory goes, was originally condensed on sort of surfaces by surface catalysis, and then was able to do simple reactions, including template other nucleotides onto itself and cause them to condense. So that was the first genome replication. And so if you can do a little work and you can replicate yourself, you're getting close to life, right?
So you're saying the nucleic acid required a catalytic surface? Could you explain?
So goes the theory. Well, people who try to put together prebiotic soups of various kinds ask what kinds of conditions, metals, temperatures, etc., could cause nucleic acid condensation. And they usually come up with some sort of a surface, you know, rock or metal. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting field, and people try to mock it up all the time, but they usually get a few nucleotides and that's about it.
So Carla, we still have remnants of that today, right? The way RNA viruses at least replicate their genomes, they still seem to like surfaces.
Exactly. They replicate on, all positive strand RNA viruses anyway, and the other RNA viruses are interesting story as well. All positive strand RNA viruses replicate on membranes and especially our beloved poliovirus, Vince, it replicates, it proliferates all these membranes in the cell and then just sits on the top of them. It's not like it tucks inside or anything to protect itself. It just uses all this surface and sets up its proteins on that surface. And these things really interest me.
So maybe that's a remnant of the primordial soups where nucleic acids were without viruses or cells, and they were just replicating on surfaces.
Well, and it's a principle that has interestingly been rediscovered by, you know, synthetic organic chemists. So surface catalysis is a big deal in chemistry. And if you ask people, why would you put all the catalysts on a surface? And the answer is, you know, if you're just going to go from A to B, then it only depends on the concentration of the catalyst. But if you're going to go from A to B to C to D using the same catalyst over and over again, then it makes sense to have it on a surface and all localized, because then you don't have to unbind and rebind and unbind and rebind to go from A to B to C to D. So, you know, there's nothing more iterative than copying an RNA genome. You know, you make a negative strand, then you make a positive strand, then you make a negative strand, then you make a positive strand. So, you know, it's not a really varied cycle. So that's why I think, you know, I think especially something like RNA replication would occur on a surface.
So maybe it's instructive to tell the listeners that there are certain kinds of RNA viruses that do that, but others do not. And perhaps understanding why they don't tells us how those reactions proceed. So the viruses with negative strands or with two strands of RNA joined together, double strand, they don't tend to need this surface, right? So they do something else instead.
But before we even get to that, I'd say, what is the positive and negative strand RNA virus versus what's a DNA virus?
Well, let's define, because these are terms that were actually defined by the ancients, including, I shouldn't say ancients, but our predecessors in the field, including including our shared postdoctoral advisor, who's David Baltimore. But, okay, so positive strand viruses are those that they come in and they have all the information necessary to make their proteins. So they are also the message for the protein, and the ribosome can just bind to them and make proteins. And that's why Vince could clone the first RNA virus, because it just had to make, all the DNA had to do was make the RNA, and then it was like a message in the cell. It's taken the other RNA virus virologists a long time to duplicate his efforts.
So that's just like messenger RNA.
So
the virus has like a piece of messenger RNA, which is the intermediate between DNA and protein synthesis.
Right, but not in RNA viruses. They don't even go there. They don't even do anything with DNA. They just take the RNA. Their lifestyle is so simple. They just take the RNA, they translate it into protein. The protein makes the negative strand RNA. The protein makes a positive strand RNA. The positive strand RNA makes more protein. It's a very intimate relationship between the RNA and protein.
Sure. It just avoids the whole DNA level. But Vincent didn't.
Yeah.
He didn't. he used the DNA, but that's how he cloned it. All right. So that makes sense for the by the way, one thing that I like to tell new guests is that there's about a half second lag. So while it sounds like there's interruptions and interjections, it's rather difficult because, well, we're several thousand miles away, and we're traveling in multiple directions. So if it's almost like we're on the moon, is just a little bit of an interjection here. There's quiet pauses here. I used to edit those out. Now I can't because we're going live. But
so Mark, it's probably worth pointing out that the reason I made a DNA copy of polio was because you can do things to DNA that you can't do to RNA, and you still can't do to this day. You can make very specific changes. You can make lots of DNA. You can make new viruses, essentially. So that's the reason why we changed polio into a DNA virus of sorts, to be able to do things in the lab with it.
Clone it at the time, especially. But I suppose you could just get a machine cranked up and make the RNA. And transfect it? Can that
that's
be
a
done?
Good
Is that
question. I'm not sure it's so easy to chemically synthesize RNA. Do you know, Carla?
I don't think anyone could really make a 7,500 nucleotide RNA in a stable way.
Okay.
No, you would still these days, you would go through a DNA because, you know, for the reasons we discussed, which is that RNA is just not as stable.
I used to dose RNAs away and spray everybody with it in the lab. Nobody joined walking the lab without washing their hands with RNAs away. It's kind of an irritant too. Used to inject it into frog eggs, but I digress. So the RNA of a poliovirus, it's a positive strand RNA. And from what I understand, it it already has the message. The cell sees that message, translates it to protein, and then that protein that the RNA or that the virus RNA makes creates a negative strand template, and it starts producing more positive strand RNA. And that's the cycle.
That's
it's very, very simplified. Yeah. And what's in counterpoint, what's a negative strand RNA or RNA virus, and which are more common?
So positive strand RNA viruses are the most plentiful viruses on the planet. There are more varieties of them than anything else. So I guess that makes them the most successful. Negative strand RNA viruses are often in the news, though. I mean, influenza is one. Ebola virus is one. So a negative strand RNA virus is one that comes in actually as a negative strand. That means it can't make any proteins. So it has to come in with all the wherewithal to copy itself before it can make any proteins. So the virion that contains a negative strand genome also has a polymerase. It has lots of RNA binding proteins that let the RNA get copied. So the first thing a negative strand virus has to do when it gets inside the cell is copy itself. So it was a little more difficult to make those infectious clones.
Hey, Carla, can I ask you a thought question? Why aren't all RNA viruses positive strand RNA viruses?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Why aren't all RNA viruses positive strand RNA viruses? If they're so successful and it's a really simple strategy, why haven't all viruses evolved to do that?
Evolutionary. The other viruses are stuck in evolutionary cul-de-sacs.
Okay,
they went all direction
that?
And just got stuck there. Well, you know, could I explain what I mean by that? I mean that was a slightly facetious answer, but I mean, not all life is perfect, right? I mean. It's interesting. We talk about evolution as being, you know, an optimizing force, but at any given time, you can only make a few steps through sequence space, through evolutionary space, to get somewhere else. You know, I mean, if a mouse suddenly, you know, thought, well, I'd be really good if I had a pouch like a kangaroo, you know, there's not going to be a mouse with a kangaroo, you know, with a pouch tomorrow, because that took so many steps of evolution. Mm. Similarly, I mean, a negative strand virus can't just convert to a positive strand virus. It would require many, many steps. So even if you would say, I'm not saying positive strand viruses are necessarily better, but there are niches and evolutionary niches that get occupied, and then you can't really deviate from that.
Sure, I think that's a beautiful answer, yeah, because most people think of evolution as a trajectory towards the best, but evolution just makes whatever can survive at a given time. And so that these negative strand and double strand viruses can survive. So they're there, and that's all there is to it.
But they're not necessarily the most abundant. They're seemingly far more complex than polio, right? Polio has, what you guys said, it was 7,500, roughly 7,400, 7,500 bases of nucleic acid. That's, you know, a fraction of a, well, I guess, is it a fraction of a gene? Fraction of a human gene with introns, of course. It's so, so small, but encodes everything it needs to take over an individual, and rapidly too. And is the success of a virus death of the, or just reproduction, death of the infected person, or not necessarily person, but species or organism?
Well, if you were Ebola virus, and you infected someone, and that person dropped down dead in 5 days, what happened to you? I mean, you don't get to spread, right? So you usually the dogma in the field of pathogenesis is that the evolution of a virus with respect to its host will be to come to some sort of equanimity, you know, with that host. That is, the virus, it's not in the virus's best interest to kill the host or even make the host sick unless that host's disease helps its transmission. So, for example, cholera, which is a bacterium that gives you diarrhea, I mean, not to be unpleasant at lunchtime, but sure. That does facilitate its transmission. And influenza, which causes you to sneeze and spit on other people, facilitates its transmission. So those pathogenic symptoms are in the interest of the microbe. But otherwise, I don't think there's any reason for a microbe to make you sick evolutionarily for the microbe.
It's probably worth pointing out that the vast majority of virus infections, at least of eukaryotes like us, not bacteria, probably don't cause illness. They don't kill the host, and they just effectively transmit the genome. Because in the end, that's how I view it. Nothing matters except the genetic information of the virus being propagated. And so that probably happens without cell death in most cases. We just don't see it.
Well, you know, right. Our body...
Did you read...
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. There was a recent paper by from the laboratory of Skip Virgin at Washington University. Maybe you guys talked about it on this show, that showed that herpes virus infection, which most of us have, I mean, most of us are latently infected with some kind of herpes virus or other, protects against some kinds of bacterial infections.
Right.
So there seems to be our relationship to herpes virus is a, you know, despite that it gives us occasional cold sores and stuff, is actually a pretty good one.
Well, isn't half our genome virus, viral origin? I mean, Dr. Church was saying that in one of the past episodes. So that's, that's when it fails, right? That's when, I guess, a virus dies, is when it just becomes integrated into the genome and doesn't replicate.
Well, it's still being transmitted, right? It goes from generation to generation. As I said before, if you just think about a genome, not a particle, not anything else, those retroviruses in us are still being transmitted. And who's to say that one day some of them won't be repaired and they will go to another host in some way? So I don't think you should view them as dead, even just because they can't make particles. They transmit pretty well.
How many viruses... Right. Particles are we carrying on our cells right now? I know that for every human cell, what is it? There's 10 bacterial cells. So if there's or more, what are the numbers? 10 trillion cells or 1 trillion cells in the human body, we're carrying 10 trillion bacteria, which make up about 2.5 kilos in mass. That's roughly about 5 pounds of bacteria, which makes you wonder, why is the human genome the human genome? It's the human genome plus the, you know, the microbial genome that we're carrying. Is the same apply to viruses? I'm wondering how many viral particles we're carrying on ourselves right now, even in a healthy individual. You mentioned herpes virus.
You know, that's part of, there's a lot of viral discovery going on. I mean, the history of studying viruses is very interesting, right? Because we studied them from the point of view of the ones that make us sick, right? And those are, that still, you know, attracts a lot of our interests. But most of them don't. And a lot of them, I think, we don't know about. For example, there have been some recent papers of new picornaviruses, is actually a Tyler's virus, which was thought to be just a mouse virus. Is, you know, a lot of people are carrying it around. I think there's a lot of virus discovery that still needs to be done. So I think it's harder to answer that question for viruses than for bacteria.
Well, I suppose that, you know, as we move towards like understanding the life sciences, you know, and we accumulate knowledge, we're eventually going to have a control of, you know, I suppose pushing what we're doing right now in 50 to 100 years, we might have a great deal of control over life. But one thing is we'll never have complete control over the viruses because it'll be, and as long as we're alive, we'll have that fight. Won't we? Maybe that's for another show. So could you tell us a little bit about the work that's going in the lab? That if you could take us you know, through the cyberspace into your lab and tell us a little bit about the projects that you're actually doing on polio and why you selected polio and how it applies to general virology and pushing our knowledge of our understanding of viruses forward. What are the main projects that are going on at Stanford?
Yeah. Well, I guess there are a couple main projects, but one of the ones that I've been really interested in lately is drug resistance in viruses, which is relevant to all of us. I mean, if you're infected with a virus, you notice that people don't give you medicine. for it, for the most part, because there aren't good medicines, especially for RNA viruses. And there's one simple reason for that. I mean, there are people working very hard on it. There are excellent drug targets. The one reason for it is the genetics of the viruses, which is they make so many mistakes as they copy themselves, that pretty soon, if it takes one or two mutations to make a drug-resistant virus, you know, it pre-exists before you even take the medicine. So, as you know, in the case of HIV that causes AIDS, people now take, you know, three or sometimes even four drugs so that they don't become, so that they don't select for drug-resistant viruses. But in the case of, how does that work?
Yeah, how does
well,
taking three
okay,
or four?
So it's a, how does...
Yeah, how does taking three or four drugs prevent the resistance or the propagation of the virus?
So it's a simple mathematical argument. Okay, if you have HIV, for example, it's 10,000 nucleotides long. And it has an error rate of about 3 times 10 to the minus 4, or let's just say 1 times 10 to the minus 4. So on average, every new RNA genome of HIV has one mutation in it. So if it takes one mutation, which is often the case, to give you resistance to a drug, and you have 10 to the fourth viruses in you, then that drug-resistant virus already pre-exists. But the problem is you have about 10 to the 10th viruses in you if you're infected with HIV. So you have, 10 to the sixth drug-resistant viruses already to the drug before you took it. So that's why you don't want to take what's called monotherapy, because you just select the drug-resistant viruses will grow. So what if you take two drugs? Then the probability is 1 in 10 to the 8th, right? So you have 10 to the 10th viruses, you have 100 of them that are resistant to both.
Oh, wow.
So if you take three drugs, the probability is 10 to the 12th, 10 to the minus 12, that it's a... Yeah, so you know, it's a good chance that if you take three drugs, that drug-resistant virus won't pre-exist. And if then all the replication of all of them is suppressed, then you won't, then that new virus won't arise. So that's why, you know, the last thing you want to do is take one drug for an RNA virus. So for example, for hepatitis C, which, 200 million people in the world have it, there's no approved, even though the drug companies are working very hard on antivirals, and there are a bunch of them, all of which are associated with drug resistance, the FDA and similar agencies in other countries won't approve a so-called monotherapy, because that would just select for a drug-resistant virus right away, and then that drug would be useless in the ultimate cocktail that they want to prepare.
So, Carla, why do we have just... basically one or two drugs for flu? Those are licensed. We have Tamiflu, also Tamivir, Relenza, two similar targets, and then the amantadines. So why were those just licensed before we understood this, or what's the story there?
Well, there is resistance associated with them, right?
Absolutely.
And and I think... it's those kinds of, I've been wondering about that. Like, why during this last swine flu episode weren't people given, I mean, you had to be very, very sick to be prescribed any drug. And I think it was to prevent the spread of drug resistance. I think they're very carefully administered, actually, or they should be.
Is it positive strains or and DNA viruses and negative strain viruses? Could you don't necessarily need to with a negative strain because of the difficulty it has to mutate away from its end state, evolutionary end state, as you called it?
No, I think the error rates are a little lower for negative strand viruses, but I think that there is the problem of drug resistance with influenza, but Vince makes a good point. I'm not quite sure why it's really a less spectacular, the arising of drug resistance is less spectacular in negative strand RNA viruses. I mean, it's so bad with hepatitis C that people are in, there are clinical trials now for all kinds of drugs, and all of them are associated with drug resistance. In fact, it's just considered the hallmark of a good antiviral that you'll develop drug resistance against it.
Wow.
But Carly, you
heard that said.
So Carly, you have this approach to antivirals that gets around that problem, and that I think we need to hear because it's really brilliant. So maybe you can explain it to everyone.
Okay. Thank you. So it has to do with the way viruses with their lifestyle. Okay. So if you're a virus and you're a newly born virus, you're born in a cell, and your mom is in that cell with you, and there are a lot of cousins and brothers and sisters all around you, and they're all slightly mutant with respect to you. Everybody, but you're all stuck in the same cell, right? So that means there's a lot of possibility to interact with each other. So the math of drug resistance that I just gave you assumes that when a drug-resistant virus is born, it's directly selected for, right? There's nothing in the way of it and expressing its drug resistance. But there can be things in the way of a virus expressing its drug resistance, namely, if it's stuck in a cell with a bunch of other viruses that are interfering with the expression of its drug resistance. So if I can give you an example. So you're in that lecture hall, okay, with 200 other people, and you're all, and you, Mark, mm-hmm. are the most fit person in that room. And the selection comes, and will you or will you not be able to express your fitness? So if the selection is, you know, let's say a flash flood, and you're the only one who can run fast, you know, you'll run out of the room, right? And mm-hmm. the fact that other people can't even get out of their chairs won't interfere with your being able to run out of the room. But mm-hmm. if you're trying to do a complicated task that involves a lot of pieces, like doing a jigsaw puzzle, and you are the world's champion jigsaw puzzler, but other people in the room are screwing up, and they're not only not able to put together their jigsaw puzzles, they're throwing their useless pieces over on your table, right? You will mm-hmm. be what we call dominantly interfered. Your ability to do your jigsaw puzzle will be dominantly inhibited by All right. the other people in the room, right?
mm-hmm.
So by that analogy, if I'm a new virus and I'm born into a cell and I'm surrounded by these unfit cousins and brothers and sisters and relatives, and I'm trying to put together, for example, a capsid, which has a lot of pieces to it, and the drug is against that capsid, their horrible little pieces will be floating near me, and I'll put together a chimeric capsid. And even though if I were left to my own devices, I could put together a drug-resistant capsid, I can't do it with them there, right?
Right.
So my thesis is that anything that is that drug targets for highly mutable viruses should be those that are highly oligomeric, that is, have lots of pieces to them, so that the drug-sensitive viruses in the same cell will interfere with the drug-resistant virus ever showing that it's drug-resistant, and it won't be selected out. That is a very complicated thought.
So what kinds of targets are, as you say, highly oligomeric? Is it two subunits or three, or are you talking about dozens?
Well, you know, that becomes really an empirical thing, right? You know, it depends on how many subunits you need to poison. So definitely capsids, you know, which for poliovirus, there are 60 copies each. For hepatitis C, it's an unknown number that are in the core, but probably 180 or so.
So I'm just going to take a quick step back. So we're talking capsid, which is the protein envelope that wraps around the nucleic acid.
Which it's the protein shell. So the envelope is the protein that sticks in the membrane of envelope viruses. Poliovirus okay. is what we call a naked virus that doesn't have a membrane, so grounded protein. And even envelope viruses like hepatitis C virus or influenza mm-hmm. have a highly iterative little shell that surrounds the nucleic acid and protects it. So even envelope viruses have this highly oligomeric, you know, you can think of it like a Buckminster Fuller dome, right? A geodesic dome or something that surrounds them that, sure. like a geodesic dome, is built of little iterative pieces that are put together in a very simple way.
Your audio is breaking up a little bit. Let me see if I understand this. We're actually having.
Should I unplug again?
No, it's good quality sound. It's the bandwidth issue there. An envelope virus like hepatitis C has a cell, almost like a cell membrane. It's made up of.
It is a cell membrane. It stole it.
It is. They stole it from the endoplasmic reticulum or the cell. You know, it pops itself out of the cell, capturing some of the cell's membrane. But inside that is like a geodesic. A 12-sided dice or maybe 18-sided dice that one might use for Dungeons and Dragons.
Exactly.
Yeah, and inside that, the nucleic acid. So it kind of looks like maybe the top of the command mod or the lunar module, and that's wrapped around with the big envelope. But not all viruses have that lipid protein envelope. Hepatitis C does, but polio doesn't.
That's right.
All right. And you mentioned that... out of the for polio, there was 60 subunits. A subunit being a protein unit. Let's see. Sometimes right. A subunit is a part of a protein unit, but you consider the capsid as one entire protein.
And there are 60 copies each of four different proteins.
Okay.
In the poliovirus shell or capsid.
So that's like four different bricks, four different colored Lego bricks forming. Taking those four, replicating it 60 times and forming that little little shape that looks like a soccer ball, perhaps.
Exactly.
Okay, I haven't counted the squares on a soccer ball, though, so I don't know if it's 60.
Yeah.
Okay, so, yeah, sometimes it's good to take a step back because when you use the terms like oligomeric subunits and...
Of course.
Yeah, I get distracted. Okay, but so go ahead.
We're trying to figure out. So I'm on a quest, mm-hmm. and I'm on a quest to convince drug companies and others that if they want to beat the problem of drug resistance, they should choose the drug targets better to begin with. And ironically, the drug targets they should choose are not the really simple things, not the enzymes, for example, that are like one little protein floating around in the cell, but the complicated things like those capsids that have 240 different pieces. Or we found in my lab that the polymerases, which are often in other systems, are just simple monomeric, you know, go it alone type enzymes. In poliovirus and related viruses, they form these large sheets on the surfaces of the membranes that on which the virus proliferates. So we found that those are a, quote, dominant drug target, unquote. And so we're just trying to, because it's a difficult concept, we're just trying to come up with a lot of very simple examples so people can get it, you know, like the jigsaw puzzle and the capsids. Sure. And yeah.
Did you say that the RNA polymerase... for polio forms a sheet? Is it a crystalline sheet of protein? Or is it just a raft?
We don't know how big this sheet is. We know when we work with the polymerase in isolation, it forms two-dimensional lattices. And that those lattices give you what we call cooperativity. That is, you get, when working together, they're faster and more efficient on some kinds of RNA than the monomers working separately, the simple proteins working separately. Yeah.
Like a multi-core processor. Make process RNA quicker, I suppose.
Right, exactly. For probably the reasons I told you about surface catalysis, if you're going to go from A to B to C to D, you know, maybe you should have all your catalysts in one place, right? So that's what we think. In any case, we came to that biochemical finding actually from the genetics. That is, we found that a lot of mutations in the polymerase were what we call dominant. That is, when you had a defective polymerase around, the other polymerases couldn't work. And the easiest way to do that is if you're part of a wall. You know, if you're part of something that has multiple subunits, then it's only as strong as the weakest link, right?
Mm-hmm.
So. As we say, yeah, so that's what we discovered first was the genetics, that there were a lot of dominant polymerase mutations. And then we thought, oh, it must be an oligomer. So that's when we started looking at the biochemistry to see, does it function in a big raft? So now what we're trying to do is figure out what it takes to make an evil protein like that. Like, how do you, as we say in the, so if you want to make, if you want to make what we call a dominant drug, if you want a dominant drug target, that is a virus that when defective will screw up all the other viruses in the same cell, you know, you have to think, what's the nastiest, what how can I make a drug that'll make this protein not non-functional, but nasty, right? So, right. So as we say in the lab, if you want to ruin a party, you can't stay home. You have right. to go to the party, and then you have to be as obnoxious as possible. So that's what we're trying to do to the viral proteins as we seek what we call dominant drug targets.
That's amazing. I'm really, first of all, this is could be a paradigm shift in the way people design antivirals. One thing I know from pharma is nobody, I mean, this is very, very, I mean, that would be considered high risk, high reward. Certainly companies like Gilead would, you know, simply rather just produce another antiviral that targets, you know, the enzymatic function of an RNA polymerase. But if you're saying you don't need to screw around with the, pardon my French here, you don't have to play around with the RNA polymerase activity, but perhaps modulate its ability to form these two-dimensional lattices or these large rafts, and then they can, you know, through being lousy at it, block the party, I mean, turn off the party. Am I understanding correctly that that's the best way to do it? Just modulate the maybe the structure or select for drugs that interfere with the ability to form these large rafts of RNA polymerase rather than attack the enzymatic activity? Or do you do both?
Well,
so
that's why we talk about the party like that, is because, so people might think that I'm simplifying for this radio show, but this is actually the way we talk in the lab too.
Sure.
if you screw up the function of the protein's ability to join the raft, then that's the equivalent of staying home and not going to the party. What you have to do is let it join the raft and then have it malfunction in some way. So what we're trying to figure out is how to have it join the raft and then malfunction. And so we're trying, and so far it's really interesting because what we've found is that if you interfere with the active site, so that's what most of the antivirals do, right? They interfere with the active site of the enzyme. Those polymerases are fine. They join the raft and they don't actually bother the ability of the other polymerases to do their thing. They just form a structural part of the raft. But the polymerases that's really inhibit the function of the raft are the ones that join, allow the polymerase to initiate, and then interfere with elongation. At least that's what it looks like so far. So if you think about, okay, I'm going to change analogies now. So if you want to stop traffic on a narrow mountain road, you don't want your car to break down in your driveway. That's the equivalent of stopping initiation, sure. Right? You want to pull out onto the highway and then have the car break down. And that'll mess everybody up, right?
That's when everybody's yelling at you.
Yeah. So that's the kind of polymerase you want to make.
How do you screen for that?
How do you screen for that?
Maybe this should be discussed off the show in the presence of some lawyers so that we can talk about how this could be commercialized. Because if this is a paradigm shift, and in my opinion, large pharma are very, very skittish about new strategies. So how would one screen? Identify molecules that can go communicate this misinformation to the rest of the gang?
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. Because most of the kinds of screening that people do is just, you need to develop a high throughput assay, you know, a fluorescent nucleotide that starts to fluoresce when incorporated or something. And then you look for, you know, a million compounds that don't do that. So usually the easiest thing to do is initiation. But, you know, if we really find, as we suspect, and we haven't published this or anything yet, but I mean, if we find, as we suspect, that it's a second and third nucleotide that you should not be able to put in, you know, that could be developed as a high throughput screen, right? We just mm-hmm. need to learn, we need to do the genetics to find out what is the biochemical explanation for genetic dominance. And that's what we're trying to do now.
So, Carla,
but I will say that.
Sorry.
Yeah, go on.
If you look at all the existing antivirals, you know, the flu, the 20 or so HIV, there's some for herpes viruses. Do any of those fulfill your criteria of being, of having this multimeric target that conveys this dominant phenotype? Do any of them function that way?
Well, the genetics haven't really been done. Maybe the closest might be amantadine for flu, because it targets something that a protein, you know, a little pore, right? That is oligomeric. I mean, that is, there are multiple subunits. So that might be. We haven't done the genetics on it to ask if you mix drug resistant and drug sensitive viruses, is drug sensitivity dominant, which is what you'd expect to see. That's a good experiment, Vince.
So how does this apply to the capsid? And then maybe a follow-up question would be, what's more strategic, preventing the nucleic acids from being replicated or preventing the particle assembly? But so first, how does it apply to capsids versus the polymerase? And then what's better? What's a better strategy for an antiviral, killing the particle formation? Is what happens if a virus actually succeeds in forming? And then you've got to start all over.
Well, I think that capsids are easier. Capsids are easier because, you know, capsids, you know, they form these little geodesic dome-like structures, right? There are many, many points of contact on the surface. So if you mess up one point of contact, it'll still glue itself onto the other surface that it'll contact. So in experimentally, almost no matter what we do to a capsid protein, it still comes to the party.
right?
It's really hard to get capsids to stay home from the party. So that means that almost anything you did, and in our hands, almost anything you do to a capsid protein makes it a dominant inhibitor of other viruses in the same cell. So I think, theory aside, as far as which would be better, what step of the replication to block, I think capsid and core inhibitors are really a great idea. And the only reason they're not pursued.
Small molecules that block the interaction of the capsid protein subunits. So you got your tetramer, heterotetramer, assembling with other heterotetramers, like, you know, those four different Lego blocks trying to build with the 60 combinations. And preventing the protein interaction, is that the way to go?
Well, you know, so what drug companies say when I talk to them is they say, well, you know, we don't like to try to block protein-protein interactions because it's really hard to have a small molecule block a whole protein surface that has, you know, 500 square angstroms of surface or something. But the point is, you don't have to block it. You have to derange it. And I think that's what's been, right? So deranging is just as good as blocking. And these are very complex structures that need to go through a lot of different conformational changes. So
am
for example,
I the only one who thinks that would be the easiest thing to do? Because these are, you know, my kid has a 3D puzzle, and finding the right piece, unless you get the right piece, it's not going to hurt it. But you jam in the wrong piece, the puzzle's finished. And the level of three-dimensional electrostatic properties, I mean, you could find a molecule that fits, a probably commercially available molecule that fits right in and destroys that. To me, I don't know. I just would tend to disagree with the pharma. Maybe the pharma are just too conservative.
Well, I think that they don't. I think that the genetics of drug resistance is not very well understood and not really appreciated. I mean, you know, it's funny. Different fields, and I'm sure this is true for the fields of all of our listeners too, is there are conceptions that come in. They're like founder effects. So if a field is founded by people who think a certain way, that's sort of historically propagated. So the field of virology and antivirals was pretty much founded by, you know, physicists and biochemists. And, you know, so there's a tendency to be very reductionist in our thinking. And I think that's fine. I mean, I'm the same way, actually. But I just found that I was wrong so much that I started doing a lot of genetics, too, to ask, what about function? You know, because sometimes you get an answer you don't expect at all.
Well, I definitely think that this genetic proof of concept, right, to demonstrate that, going after the complex structures in the virus might be the best way to go. It seems really, really exciting. And I think it's a great honor for us to be able to talk to you about this, you know, frontier of virology. Right? I sometimes forget that we have this great opportunity here on TWiT to bring in scientists that are really pushing things forward. And this seems like, you know, still early stage, but it could really change and save how many people die from a viral infection per year on Earth. Right, and if you're changing the way people are treated, you could literally your discoveries could save, I don't know, 50 to 100 million lives a year. It's an amazing thing to be able to come in this close to the frontier, and I really, really appreciate it.
Well, my goal is, as you can tell, these concepts are difficult to understand, and so what we're trying to do is to come up with a lot of simple examples. And we're testing, as Vince pointed out, you know, there are a lot of antivirals out there. So because the concepts are kind of hard to describe, what we're doing in my lab now is we're testing, selecting for drug-resistant variants of all the, you know, frontline hepatitis C virus drugs and testing to see whether they have any dominant, whether the drug-sensitive viruses can interfere with the drug-resistant ones. And we don't think they will. And then trying to show that simple compounds that little companies are making, you know, that affect the cores and the other proteins that make, you know, highly iterative structures will have that property. And so then we're hoping to be able to communicate this concept a little better and more practically.
Well, it's pretty amazing. I just really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you.
Vincent, do you have another question or?
Well, Mark, it depends how much time you have, because I could ask many, many more questions. Maybe can I ask one more? I don't know. Do you have enough time for one question?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. So there is there's an interesting approach to antivirals. In one hand, as you've discussed, you make antivirals that inhibit viral functions. But there is another approach, which is to make drugs that inhibit cell functions that the virus needs in order to reproduce. So maybe you could just give us your thoughts on how that would fare in terms of resistance. Is that more or less likely to give rise to resistance if you target a cell?
I think the use of cellular, the identification of cellular targets is very, very promising. And should in principle, you know, so the idea for our listeners is if you target something in the cell that the virus absolutely needs, then how's it going to, the cell doesn't mutate at anywhere near the rate of the virus. And so what's the virus going to do? It's either going to die, which is what we want, or it's going to evolve not to need that cellular component. And if that route is not available to it, then it will die. In some cases, when people have targeted cellular components, you do get viruses that evolve not to need that cellular component. For example, there's an inhibitor of hepatitis C virus that targets a proline isomerase that helps one of the viral proteins fold. And what you end up selecting for is folding variants that just don't need that cellular enzyme to fold. But a great thing would be a cellular protein that you'd have to develop that's, for example, required that worked on the capsids, like a heat shock protein, right? And that, mm-hmm. that there's some of that in the literature. And then not only would you be targeting the cellular protein, but then the virus to evolve not to need it, it would have to do so in all its oligomers at the same time. So you could have this combined dominant drug target effect and the cellular protein. I think that would be the way to take just one drug for an RNA virus infection.
Well, this is going to be a little bit insider baseball, but there'll be a few people listening that'll be interested. How about a drug like deoxynucleomycin? Is that how you pronounce it? That blocks glucosidase 2, that is an enzyme that's required for ER assembly of the HCV viral envelope glycoproteins. And perhaps if you block access to the chaperones in the ER, like calnexin and calreticulin, you could screw up the envelope. Do you believe that the process works? I mean, it's been published by a couple of glycobiology groups.
Sure. I mean, it all works. These things often work in a couple cycles in tissue culture. And I don't know that work very well specifically, but, okay. You know, it's an empirical, it's an experimental question. You know, anytime, you know, viruses can explore a lot of sequence space. They can't explore endless sequence space, as we were talking about earlier. You know, they can't decide to completely change their life cycle. But they can explore a lot of sequence space. So whether or not they can develop resistance to it or not is not a theoretical, it's an experimental question.
So I guess the big question for you is to understand how to eliminate the drug resistance, more that so than just being able to knock out the function of one protein at a time and hoping that that drug sells for so many years until it becomes useless, right? It's really to tackle the process and the understanding of drug resistance.
And to understand the genetics of drug resistance,
yes.
In a way that doesn't involve, you know, let's take three or four crummy drugs and put them together. Now, you know, I have a lot of friends in pharma, but, you know, frankly, I mean, it's good for pharma if they can take three or four drugs and put them together, right? I mean,
sure.
There are a lot of very affluent people infected with HCV. Well, yeah. Exactly. But, you know, HIV is a big problem. Positive strand viruses are a bigger problem because there's even more amplification associated with them. They never have this DNA copy. So I think, you know, we'll probably need four in a cocktail.
Wow. Well, I really appreciate you coming on. This has been an absolute honor to join your lab here at Stanford from Cleveland. I guess it's a good time to say goodbye, but I really appreciate you coming on. I mean, this is really it's really at the forefront, and getting into your lab is just an opportunity for all of us, and it's greatly appreciated.
Thanks. It's fun talking to you.
And also, so that was Dr. Carla Kierkegaard. She's professor and chair of the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at Stanford University School of Medicine. And we also have Vincent Ragnaiello, who is the host of This Week in Virology and This Week in Parasitism and professor of microbiology at Columbia University. Thank you, Vincent, for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Whenever you have a virus urge, Mark, just give me a call and I'll get my buddies on like we did today.
Well, viruses are pretty scary. You know, when H1N1 started coming out, it posed an imminent threat on the population, right? And you know, it makes for a really great discussion because they're small and simple, at least fairly simple to visualize, and give us really great in-depth understanding of biology, right, as in its simplest form. So thank you. We should possibly get David Baltimore on to, you know, your old the mentor that that helped put you two guys on the map. You know,
that would be great.
Give you the train. Yeah. That would be fantastic. I'd also like to thank Colleen Kelly for producing the show today. She managed the boards and did a great job of video switching and everything. Thank you, Colleen. I'd also like to thank the team that make this possible, Leo Laporte, Dane Golden, Eric Lanigan, Tony Wang, and the rest of the team in Petaluma, California. If you'd like transcripts to the show, you can get them at futuresinbiotech.com. They're made available by the kind folks at Pods in Print. If you need transcripts done, they can handle even the most technical. And there's a few behind, but I'm bugging Tom, so he'll have them up soon. Lastly, I'd like to thank Phil Peltier and Will Hall for the opening and closing themes. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltier.